Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Mona Shaw, welcome back.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
I am doing fantastic, but probably not as good as you are. I want to issue you a congratulations. Again, you are on the top 25 list of immigration attorneys this year for 2017, according to EB5 Investor Magazine. Well done.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And also, so is our guest today.
That's right. Today we have joining us David Herson. David is the managing partner of David Herson & Partners LLP and has worked in the EB5 cases since the program was established. In 1991, David personally prepared and filed one of the very first EB5 cases, and he filed many of the EB5 cases that were approved through the first 10 years of the EB5 visa program. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be on it, and thank you for inviting me.
I'm happy to have you. And again, congratulations to you as well on being on this top 25 list of immigration attorneys for 2017.
Thank you. I see that Mona and I have both been on it since the inception annually.
I noticed that. It's not just this year. You two are among the alumni elite of that list.
That's a mouthful, Mark. Well, thank you. But also, you'll find that the more you get to know EB5, the more you realize how many nuances and difficulties there are there. And there really is only a select amount of lawyers who really specialize in EB5. Although there's a lot of lawyers who do, you know, source of fund filings, there's not a lot of lawyers who do project work as well as the actual filings, too.
It's a very small group. I know there's about 15,000 immigration attorneys across the U.S. that's associated with the American Immigration Lawyers Association. About 8,000 of them identify as business immigration, but maybe 300 of those actually do EB5 work.
That's right. As I say, there's a lot of nuances. And I would say, and I think David would agree with me, that EB5 is perhaps maybe 15% immigration law and perhaps 85% everything else, business, corporate, SEC, etc.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. I also say that this is the most complicated immigration type case that you can look to prepare. And therefore, I can only recommend that people go to the top experts in the field, because failures can be disastrous to a family and a loss of money.
Right, because we're not just talking about an immigration failure. We're also talking about people who've put their life savings often into a project. This really brings us, Mark, to today's program, because David is such an expert in this area, that when you are putting a project together, whether it be an entrepreneurial direct pooled, or a regional center, there is a common element which goes all the way through, and that is you're looking at an actual business.
That's right, a business that the investor, well, is investing in.
Yeah, this becomes even more focused when we get into the discussion on direct investments, because the regional center model, generally, other people have prepared the actual business, although the immigration lawyers have been involved in the paperwork. There are two types of programs. There's a regional center program and the direct hire investment program. The difference basically is that you can use the regional center program to create the jobs required by the program, 10 for each investor, by utilizing econometric matrices and reasonable methodologies. Whereas with a direct hire, you have to actually have 10 people full-time on payroll.
So David, you mentioned with regional centers, you mentioned there's that economic analysis, and I think it has something to do with the money that's invested. Not only does it create direct jobs, but these also indirect and induced jobs. Is that one big difference from a regional center versus a direct EB5 investment?
Yeah, in analysis, that is the major difference. There are some others, but that is the major difference. It's the way you calculate the jobs. And with direct you have to have the individuals on payroll, where you could have a mix or only economic calculations for the job count on the regional center type projects.
You mentioned there are other differences. What are some of those other differences with the regional centers?
Well, the regional centers generally pooled with management unrelated to the investor. The investor does not operate on a day-to-day basis, whereas the direct hire, the investor is either one or a few investors that get together, or a small pool, and for each investor, they have to hire 10 full-time workers who are legal and on payroll. They can be the day-to-day managers, that's the investors, or they can qualify under a different program to be indirectly the managers. Whereas with the regional center programs, they generally qualify under the direct management part of the program.
David, I don't know if you're seeing in your practice, but we have seen a real trend over the last couple of years for friends to pool together. I mean, it's a pooled investment. So some of the friends are obviously, you know, part of their investment is probably more passive. But what we're seeing is that maybe instead of going into a regional center, four or five friends come together, pool their money and buy a business.
Right. That is correct. The issue with buying a business, of course, is it has to qualify, because the basic rule is that you have to have a new business. So then you can qualify for certain exceptions, which I don't know if it's a subject of this program, but we can elaborate on it at a later time if you wish.
Yeah, but I also, one of the biggest mistakes people do think is that they can go out and just buy an existing hotel. I mean, that happens so many times. Somebody will call us and say, okay, I bought a hotel and it's already got 20 jobs, so I don't have to do anything. And then we have to say, no,
you have to create
new jobs. Exactly.
Correct. Unless there's the one exception where you can prove that you're saving existing jobs in a failing business, and that requires at least 20% loss of the equity of the business over the last 1 or 2 years. If that can be established, then you save the jobs that are there. So let's, for example, say there are 15 existing jobs. You want 2 or 3 investors. The first investor will take the first 10 safe jobs. The second investor will take the remaining 5 existing jobs and add another 5 full-time jobs. And the third investor will have to, of course, add a full 10 jobs. And that can be extended to any size that you want, as long as the employment base is there and the money is being used to create that business and those jobs. It can't be a lot of money, most of it lying in a bank account, or immigration will deny the case based on your money's not creating the jobs, therefore you don't qualify. So there's a lot of careful analysis that we as attorneys have to do to try and assist you through the selection of your actual program. The ultimate risk of the business will be the investors, but the guidance through the immigration qualifications rests on Mona and me and others who do this kind of work.
Yeah, it's also important to point out that many times a person doesn't realize that it is actually not so easy to spend money. We have cases, for example, where it's $1 million investment, but just because the project's not in a TEA, and they've easily managed to spend $300 or $400, and now we are looking to see where can they spend the rest of the money. So even well before you start, you need to have a plan in action as to how the money gets spent, because you're absolutely right, David. You know, USCIS is going to come back and say, well, how has the money that you've invested created jobs at all?
Well, the flip side of that, of course, is if you're in a $500,000 area and you want to hire 10 people, just on a practical basis, when you pencil out the business expanding going forward, unless you are very successful, it's highly unlikely that you'll be sufficiently capitalized. So you could land up with a losing business, which means you lose your money and the green card. And so you have to be very careful not to undercapitalize your business while meeting the minimum required for immigration.
You know, that's exactly right. And that's one of the reasons we often sort of try and persuade clients away from standalone or entrepreneurial type projects just because we can see that they're not going to get beyond the first year. Especially people who've come from overseas who don't understand how much you actually pay out with 10 investors. If you take 10 investors at the minimum wage, but by the time you've paid workers' compensation and all the other taxes, etc., it's quite a bit out of pocket.
Correct. Well, when I came into this country, I'm also an immigrant, but almost 40 years ago, I'm also a US citizen today, we went into a business and it was undercapitalized. It wasn't related to immigration at all. But even with a million or more, it was not sufficient to keep that business going and become viable. So it needs really close analysis. Now, I know certain countries have people who really are confident in what they can do in business. And with a little bit of schooling, they will take any business and make it successful. Those folks need to also carefully analyze the situation because they'd rather perhaps put $500,000 into a regional center project and use other monies to go with the direct. But if that's not feasible, then the direct investment program is definitely one to be considered. We also have this situation where the regional center program has sunset several times since it began, and we're monitoring what happens to that and how it will be extended. Whereas the direct investment program is a permanent program. So unless Congress acts to terminate that program, which we don't think is likely, your direct investment is ongoing and you haven't got the fear of possible sunsetting of your legal basis for doing the immigration.
Well, let's explore that, because that sounds like a big difference between regional center versus direct, because this regional center is a pilot program, right? And this pilot program could go away. So let's talk a little bit more about what that could mean.
Okay, well, the pilot program, they removed the word pilot a couple of years ago,
okay,
which gave us the clue that they're going to make it permanent, and Congress just did not do that. And they bumped it forward sometimes as little as 2-3 weeks at a time while they're busy sorting out other issues unrelated onto which the EB-5 extension is tagged on. So we're going to monitor this and we'll see how it develops over the year. And hopefully soon we will have a more permanent program, 5-6 years, and people will be more comfortable investing under the regional center program. With the direct, you don't have that issue coming into play at all.
Mark, so it's whenever you're putting up a business, it's not just the direct jobs that you see. Because when we're talking about direct jobs, say, for example, if it's a hotel, then a direct job in that hotel would perhaps be, say, the receptionist or a waiter in the restaurant. But then the business itself is an economic growth within that area. There are so many hidden jobs which come out. And the other areas where they look for the economic growth, this is the fact that as you are employing people, people have money in their pocket and they're going out and spending, and that spending is also creating jobs. So it's a wonderful idea, and I feel and David, I think you can agree with me that the idea of a regional center is something which is totally unique to the United States. I haven't seen this type of program in any other country.
Interestingly enough, these particular economic calculations are done by local and state governments when assessing various developments within their jurisdictions. So the programs are considered valid and ongoing, although when you look at it from an investor standpoint, you say we've created 100 jobs and you don't see one single person standing there once the building has been completed. It's an interesting and sometimes difficult concept to grasp.
Right. There are so many other little nuances, though, getting back to our topic, there's so many nuances when you are putting up a project that it's often more sensible for somebody who just wants to get their immigration to go into a regional center, which has a feasible project. And then they be able to set up their own project themselves, or their own business rather, themselves, and focus on that business without having the worry of immigration.
Yes, well, when I came into the country, my two brothers came along and they decided to go into a business. The considerations there were not immigration, but the business is complex, and if you don't understand the US system, you can fail. So the way they started was to do it the way they used to do it overseas. And doing this caused the business just to go downhill at a very, very fast rate. So once they learned the way the US does the same thing, they brought in these different fairly minor changes and the business took off. So it's really the local way of doing things. Don't swim against the tide, swim with it. You're more likely to be successful. And this comes from personal direct experience.
That's a good point, David. And I think what Mona was hinting at is it's okay to do your immigration investment through a regional center and perhaps be hands-off with that money. And if you want to pursue your entrepreneurial dreams in the U.S., then you are now free to do that without the constraints of, say, immigration, and have your investment into another business and not worry about the jobs created and those sorts of things. You already have a regional center that's taking care of that for you.
Exactly right, Mark. And I touched on that a little earlier, that you invest in a regional center project and carry on and set up your own business separately from that.
Okay.
We're all on the same page.
A lot of investors, though, do come into the country and will go to an immigration attorney. And they will ask that immigration attorney, they will want to set up their own business. And the problem is that we often find, because we do a lot of troubleshooting, is that that particular immigration attorney may not really understand the nuances of EB-5. And from the very outset, there are mistakes. And one typical mistake that I've often seen is the fact that people believe that if it's an entrepreneurial visa, they can only do $1 million investment. And, you know, perhaps they, as I said before, perhaps you don't need $1 million, but they don't realize that, no, it's related to the TEA area.
Right. The initial law in 1990 created the basis for EB-5, which included the two-tier level of investment. When the regional center came in a couple of years later, it carried that forward. So the concept that mistakenly got out to the world was that if it's a regional center, it must be $1 million. If it's a direct, it can be 500,000. And as Mona said, this was a fallacy, and 500,000 prevails in both based on location.
So the target employment area is based off of the location, not the project. So you could have a direct or regional center that is either inside or outside a target employment area, and that's going to change your investment hurdle. It's not so much the investment type itself.
That's right. But then they also have to see what motivates an immigrant to come. For example, if the immigration investment is for a student who intends to be in university for the next 4 to 5 to 6 years, then obviously that investor cannot go out and manage a business. So for that particular investor, it obviously makes a lot better sense to go into a regional center.
Also, another point which I believe is very valid is that we as attorneys will look at the overall picture of the individual investor, and there may be a different category, not EB-5, that fits this investor better than EB-5. So go to attorneys who understand the whole spectrum and aren't just locked into the thought of EB-5. There's a lot of room to do many other things.
That's a great point, actually, David. That's a great point. But we should actually spend some time on the pros and cons of both direct versus regional center, even though we actually have been talking about that, just so that our listeners do understand that as well as your individual issues, there are other advantages and disadvantages.
Sure. Well, one of them is the day-to-day management. If you want to really be active in your business, the way to do it is to go as a direct investment. If you want to sit in Florida when the business is in California and not be involved in day-to-day business, then a regional center is a requirement. That's not to say that a direct investor has to be on a day-to-day basis, but generally those who want the smaller type direct investment standalone business do want to be involved in the business and do want to earn an income from it to support themselves and their families.
I've often found also, David, that some clients who get upset with regional centers when they have no communication from that regional center. You know, they like the project initially, they will put money into the project, and then there's silence for years and years until it's time to do an 829, etc. And they just get upset that there is no continuous communication.
Right. Well, what Mona's referring to on an I-829 is that when you get your green card under this program, you get a 2-year conditional residence. And just before the 2 years are up, you have to file to remove those conditions. And you need information from the project. However, communication with the regional center is not as valuable as communication with the project to get the documents and information you need to apply for the removal of condition. So really, you probably don't get much communication from the project either, because they're in the business of developing the hotel or whatever else they're doing, and they probably are not going to look at trying to bend over backwards to assist investors. Some of the regional centers are very expert at this and will be fully informative to the investors. Others you'll have difficulty getting hold of. I have a couple of cases at the moment where it's time to remove conditions and we can't find where the developer or their people are. The job was done, but we need the documents to prove the various issues. So it is an issue. And then the other part of it is you want to ask immigration, USCIS, what's going on. And in this case, that's almost impossible. Most times you'll send an email and yes, they'll respond fairly quickly with the EB-5 program, but the answer will mainly be non-responsive. It'll be something like, the case has attention and it's in its order, sorry, we're running a bit late. Or it'll be, the case is with an examiner, you can expect a response soon. This doesn't give anyone any real sense of what's going on, and it's very difficult to be able to advise clients and satisfy their need to have status reports. We have some cases where we have requested status reports from immigration every month for a year after the due date of that processing. And eventually, we are forced to actually file in federal court to force the immigration to adjudicate the case. We don't like doing it, but sometimes there's no option.
That's right. David, if I ask you, what, in your opinion, though, if you're in a project, let's say we take two projects, one is a direct pooled project and another one is a regional center project. Obviously, with a direct pooled project, we would have to have direct jobs. And with the regional center project, you can have your indirect and induced jobs. But both projects are a little short on the final job count. Which do you think has the advantage over the other when we are really scraping the barrel for the last jobs?
I think this is an opinion, and mine is that I would go with a direct hire, because if you're able to prove that within a reasonable time after the 2 years you will be hiring the additional folks, you will get an approval. And my best example was a building that was partially completed and would not be completed for another 2 to 3 years for very, very good reasons out of the control of the project. And I got all of the conditions removed for all of those investors, although they weren't anywhere near completing the project. This may be an aberration. It may have been luck, and maybe even we had a good lawyer writing the documents. I don't know. At the same time, we got it. That's the bottom line is the success.
I happen to agree with you, because when you're looking at a regional center model, it's all about the cash, the financial model. And if you really haven't spent the money, there really isn't any way to show that on a later stage.
Right. There are two bases for these, more than two, but the two main ones are you calculate the amount of the spend on the development, and that generates a certain number of jobs. And you also calculate from the operations or the revenue of the project. Now, I've come across some of the projects that never made the anticipated revenue. Once again, and this is under Regional Center, we pointed out that there were reasons for the delay in the growth, and the growth is coming, and I was successful in getting the conditions removed. But it's far more risky than the direct hire, which specifically says if you show you can hire these people within a reasonable time, you're in good shape.
Yeah. USCIS have got a lot better, I have to agree, in looking at businesses and seeing that, yes, there are business-related reasons why you can't have the full job count right now. I remember in the early days, they were pretty strict. In that respect, they've become a little bit more flexible.
Right. I agree with you. Still, not able to approach them at all.
Well, David, thank you so much for diving into some of the differences with direct EB-5 investments and regional centers. And at the top of the show, when we first talked about EB-5, you mentioned that EB-5 is about 15% immigration and 85% business. I know all the immigration forms are out there and available and available for free. Anyone can download them and even fill them out for themselves. The I-526 itself is a relatively short form compared to some of the visa applications with the I-129s. So I feel weird asking a couple of the top immigration attorneys in the nation this, but couldn't someone just get the 526 and file their own EB-5? Yeah, direct EB-5, not a regional center, because obviously you have to go through a regional center. But when we're talking about direct, could someone conceivably file the paperwork themselves?
So, Mark, you want to start your own idiot's guide to filing EB-5?
Well, no, I know legally I can't write a legal guide because I'm not an attorney. I don't want to start some unlawful practice. I don't want to be seen as a notario that advises people on how to fill out this paperwork when obviously I'm not licensed to do that. I guess my question is really around people doing it themselves.
Yes, they certainly can. This is a minefield. If you take one step wrong in a series of questions, which all have a whole lot of underlying requirements and you don't know them, you are bound to fail. The form, by the way, Mark, has grown to many, many more pages.
It's 28 pages, actually.
So it's not a straightforward form. It's not a name and address form. It's a very intricate analysis of the business and of the individuals involved. And so if incorrectly filled out, there's a high probability of a straight denial.
You know, David, you just pointed out a great reason why you should work with an immigration attorney that knows this, because I'm going off of old knowledge of the 526 when it was only 5 or 6 pages. But both of you are like, oh, it's like 20 some pages now. Maybe that's why you should seek an immigration attorney. And what best than two of the top 25 across the nation?
Right. And what we have as well, you've got law change, you've got regulation change, you've got practice change from immigration, and you've got unknown change, which comes up when you get your next response from immigration, surprising you with some new interpretation of something they've been doing in exactly the opposite way for the last 10 years. These are things that we keep our fingers on the pulse on, and we have different associations we belong to and different publications we regularly get. It's something that is a living, moving forward program, and if you're not up to date with it, you will fall into a trap like a short I-526 form.
I certainly would agree with that. This podcast has been going on for a couple of years now, and in that time, there's already been a lot of change. David Herson, thank you so much for coming on EB-5 Investment Voice. And can we have you back on in the near future?
Yes, I'd love to be back on. I find this very interesting, and working with Mona is an absolute pleasure.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, Mona, as well.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.